Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners, and we're happy to have you with us for our podcast again this week. This week, we're going to be talking with Byron Laughlin. We have a two-part conversation that we'll be sharing the second part next week. And Byron is the founder and CEO of the Center for Board Excellence. He's a sought-after expert on board governance, and he has a great background as a CEO, as a director in a number of organizations. He's worked with nonprofits as well as Fortune 100 companies. He has worked internationally, and very interesting background, and looking forward to our conversation for the next 2 weeks with Byron Laughlin. Byron, can you first off give us just a little bit of your background and kind of an overview of your career?
Sure, happy to do that. I started in politics. I worked in the congressional cycle of 83, 84 out of college, back when for the National Republican Congressional Committee for 2 years. I was really just looking for a job, and my congressman in Michigan happened to be a Republican. And back then, unlike today, there was great camaraderie between Republicans and Democrats, because sure. I ended up doing some work with actually Tip O'Neill and his crowd a bit back then. So my first indoctrination into leadership at that kind of level was working on consensus and working together and advancing the greater good. After that, I got involved in a leadership institute in DC that helped promote internships internationally that would place interns in places like offices on Capitol Hill and embassies. I did that for 5 years, and that was very rewarding as a young person. I did that in my mid-20s to build relationships with people from around the world that were coming to learn, and some of them from less developed countries, really coming to learn about our system of government and business. And then I spent 25 years in finance and in business, and ultimately ending that part of my career as the CEO of an investment and development and home building company that was sold in 2007 with no magic prior to the financial crisis and no magic, no crystal balls there. And then that, so I had a year, almost 2 years to kind of think about what I wanted to do next, but I knew it was in the area of leadership. And I had a hunch that it was in the area of working with boards at the higher level, because I had gone back to Harvard Business School to their 3-year executive program to learn more about leadership and leadership strategy. And that started the ball rolling in 2002. That led to me starting this company in 2010.
Great. So your interest in leadership, you've seen it in different sectors on the government side as well as in business. But tell me a little bit more about kind of your motivation for starting the Center for Board Excellence.
Well, I believe that leaders, and I subscribe to the notion that leaders really want to move on an ongoing basis from good to great. And that's a dynamic, ongoing function. And I don't believe that any of us ever arrive at sort of that pinnacle, as Jim Collins calls it, the level 5 leadership, that is in a sense at an end of our leadership experience. It's more an ongoing dynamic. And in seeing that and learning about great leaders that had developed both within companies and other places, but I'm going to focus today entirely on companies, because that's where our focus and our energy is largely given to organizations that want to improve their board and the relationship between the board and management. And so I saw that there was a missing piece. A professor friend of mine at Harvard, Jay Lorsch, had indicated that really boards were underperforming in the thousands, 2000 through 2010. And when you see something that's underperforming, it also means there's an opportunity of some sort.
Sure.
And so I thought maybe there's an opportunity for a business here and to be able to, in a sense, double down on my desire to see great leadership advanced and to be a part of assessing what does, how do we determine what board effectiveness is and how do we better delineate and define this notion of board effectiveness. It's a word that it's a phrase that's used often, and particularly the word effectiveness, but it wasn't well defined before, and even governance was less defined. This is something that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years to a much greater degree. And so that really was the catalyst to get the Center for Board Excellence going. And what we found, I'll just fast forward for you and your listeners, that it is something that is highly desirable by many board members and board leaders, and it was a missing link in our global society of business and board leaders.
So talk to me a little bit about the effectiveness side. You know, I think there's probably, and you've probably run into that, there's probably a lot of viewpoints around that, but kind of as an organization working with boards and CEOs, how would you define kind of on a high level what an effective board looks like?
I look at it both for the group and for the individual. What we focus in on are five key attributes: the intellectual, the emotional, the spiritual, the innovative, and the relational. And I'll go through those quickly. The intellectual has to do with those elements of knowing the business, knowing the science, how to read a balance sheet. And I'm describing, if you're a board member or a leader, the things that you want to develop is the ability to, whatever your area of strength is, to build upon that in the area of the intellectual so that you can understand risk better, can understand finance better. How does your product differentiate itself in the marketplace? What difference does it make to the end users, whoever that is, to the stakeholders, and ultimately to your shareholders also? They're a key part of the stakeholder group. If I use the word stakeholder, I don't want anyone out there to think I'm negating at all the shareholder and return on investment, because I strongly believe in a capitalism for more people than for less. I'm not going to mitigate the need for expanded capitalism. We just need to do it in a more effective way. And therefore, the other areas that are key, the emotional has to do with how we present ourselves and how we read others. What is our self-awareness level when we go into a given situation? If you're in sales, if you're working in an office environment where you're interacting with others, how are you coming across to the other people? And there's great resources out there like Strength Finders and DISC and Myers-Briggs and all these kinds of things that I think are terrific, frankly. And we study those here in our psychometrics at CBE. And then the spiritual, I want to emphasize to people, regardless of your religious viewpoint, we all believe in something. I loved a concert I went to years ago, Bob Dylan, before he lit up the song, he said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And I think that if you don't believe in something, then you've got confusion in your life. So, but it really comes down to, what are the core values of your company? And what does your company represent in the marketplace? And then we're all in the innovation business today, in one way or another. Here we are at CBE. We are a technology company first and foremost. What we introduced in 2010 was a technology by which people could use to assess the quality of their board effectiveness and their relationship with management. And the last of that, how all this comes together in a relationology. I have a friend in England named Matt Bird. He has a company called relationology.co.uk. I thought that was such a terrific idea to come up with about the relation. Nobody had ever used this term before, which amazed me, that the relationology of an organization, what is its what is studying the organization? How do the people all relate together, which goes straight to this notion of culture. And then something I want us to get into is, why does culture eat strategy? One of the famous Peter Drucker quotes.
Right.
And so that's the approach that we have and have found to be very successful and desirable by boards, to really understand how they relate to one another in these five areas.
Yeah. So let's jump into that the topic that you raised regarding that culture eats strategy. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts around that as you've worked with companies.
Well, I think that what I've observed, and much of this, I'm in the fortunate position to be observing companies. We work with companies from Fortune 20 level companies up all the way through not-for-profit organizations. Because mm-hmm. we look at board members, hopefully, when they walk into the boardroom or when they pick up their board book and are reading it, that they're doing it with the same mission and intent, regardless of if it's a Fortune 100 company or if it's a not-for-profit in the local community, that there's a similar mission-driven element to that. And so within that, you have a tone within a company or a culture. And it's kind of like the air we breathe. And if that air is toxic, it really doesn't matter how good your strategy is. It will eventually destroy the organization. If we look at what Uber did, Uber saw the potential for a toxic culture forming, and they corrected it very quickly. And now apparently there's an improving culture. We all get off our rails a little bit here or there, and they were losing their way a bit, but it's good to see companies correct their behavior and move forward. So I another current one, we would all hope, I hope that Elon Musk is a huge winner. But if he were listening to this podcast, I'd say, Elon, please get with your board if you're not already, and talk with them and ask them questions about mentorship and how you can be the most effective and win for all of us in civilization. I mean, the guy's brilliant and doing hopefully great things, but he did some things there for a while that are questioned. Fortunately, I haven't heard as much from that. And those are just large examples of how I think a culture could be injured very rapidly if the leadership isn't taking note of how that affects the lives of all stakeholders.
So you mentioned the idea that culture eats strategy. So that strategy is important for a company. How does that play as far as kind of, and how is strategy misunderstood?
That strategy is how you are different. Mm-hmm. What makes our product special, and why does somebody want that product, and why should it grow? And answering those questions, I think, are key to the orientation of what is strategic and what is strategy. And if the culture is not supporting the notion of that growth, if we eventually find out today, I mean, one of the great differentiators today of holding culture accountable is social media. Mm-hmm. So we have things like Glassdoor, and we even have, you can even read things on Facebook or Twitter about a company. And I mean, we want to be careful because there can always be a disgruntled person who just has an axe to grind that mm-hmm. is possibly even wrong in their assessment of a situation. But if I went to Glassdoor and I read 500 descriptions of the culture of a company that were all similarly consistent, that express concern about what was going on, I think we generally would recognize that there's probably a problem in that company. And if they haven't started addressing it already, then I think that culture is going to eat that strategy, no matter how successful it is. And they may sell the company because they can't fix the culture, and the buyer may be the fixer. But they'll probably sell it for 2% or 50% of the actual value. of the company, assuming it was a very popular product. I mean, I'm kind of looking at it how great products fail toxically. I mean, American Apparel was an example of that several years ago. They ended up having they were on almost every street corner in some of the large cities of America, and now you can't find one because of a toxic culture.
Interesting. So talking about, you know, a company has a strategy to acquire, you know, customers, but, you know, that whole idea as far as, I think there are some companies that go after each customer thinking that they're equal, but sometimes compromise their overall mission. Talk about that as far as kind of the customer acquisition and the importance of picking, focusing on the right customers.
This is a area where I try to spend a lot of time learning, and that is in the area of customer selection. Because naturally in our business, if somebody came to us and wanted us to help them fix some element of their board, we would want to partner with them and help in that area. But if they want us to sort of check the box so they can look like they've got a good housekeeping seal on the door, but inside the building is toxicity, then we want to be careful to learn and discern what is a great product. And in our area, the great product is a partnership with a board that does desire excellent leadership and an excellent culture in their organization. So customer selection, I think, though, in any business is key. And I would, even down through a not-for-profit organization, I would suggest you want to be careful who you select as a customer and who you desire as a donor, because there could be unintended consequences come along with that customer. And so I think the customer selection process is one that should be thought through a series of questions at the leadership level. Who are we really trying to serve? How do we do it most effectively? And are there customers, are there unintended consequences that we could encounter through a customer relationship that would be undesirable for the long-term benefit of the organization?
That's an interesting point. I think everybody looks at, especially in the nonprofit world, you get a donor and you want all the donors you can get, but I think you're right. You can definitely compromise your values depending on who that donor, major donor is. So talk to me about some advice that you would give to, there's some new executives, leaders that are maybe in their first CEO role. They've not been in that position to work with a board. What advice would you give a new executive?
So in going back through the five items I listed before, it's initiate a relationship with the board chair or some sort of lead position on the board. If it's a small private company, the CEO and chair could quite likely be the same person. Mm-hmm. But think of the board as a partner and even as a peer mentor type relationship. I would hope that a board in a private environment would have that kind of trusted advisor. And are you willing to really hear what they have to say about the accountability structure of the organization? Because as a CEO demonstrates their ability to be accountable, the organization is going to sense some of this culturally down through the organization and have a similar approach to accountability. I think that to use the term, interestingly, that could be toxic in a positive manner, or it could be viral is the better term that we use today. In a viral manner, the notion of being accountable for excellence in an organization is set as a tone from the top. So if the somehow, without inappropriately disclosing too much, because there's decorum and there's a balance of how much we disclose and all we do in our relationships with others, that the relationship between the CEO and sometimes between a few members of the management team and the board is key for all the stakeholders to have a sense they're doing their job well. They care about what we care about. And hopefully that's great product, profitability, success, and a great stakeholder customer relationship. And so I think that one of the areas that we often ask the question, if you were charged with being a coach or mentor in a given situation, say with a fellow board member or between a chair and a CEO, how would you coach this person to improve professionally over the next year? I think that's a good question, whether or not we are, I mean, shift back to the notion of Jim Collins, good to great. The differentiator was strength of will and humility. And I think the humility function is volunteering to be accountable. I don't think one is accountable unless they volunteer to be that way. And I think that really shows a tremendous strength of character for someone to invite accountability.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.